You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
I've spent a fair bit of my professional life among devils. Dante's gigantic Satan never was much of a talker, but Marlowe's Mephistopheles and Goethe's diminished version of Mephisto never shut up. Milton's Satan lies so much that he convinces himself, and the strange devil who visits Ivan in The Brothers Karamazov remains a logic-chopping favorite of mine. But as much time as I spend with literary devils, and as much time as I spend talking to theologians, I don't spend a lot of time talking with theologians about devils. So today we're going to try to correct that, as Christian Humanist Profiles welcomes Dr. Philip Ziegler to talk about his recent book, God's Adversary and Ours, A Brief Theology of the Devil. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
I'm thrilled to be able to speak to you about it. Thanks.
Your opening chapter investigates two seemingly contradictory constellations of phenomena. In recent decades, while many Protestant theologians set out to bypass the devil, your phrase, in metaphorical, the metaphorical use of demons and devils and such, what you call demonic poetics, again your phrase, remains quite common in contexts as diverse as warfare, relationships, addiction, economics. You can tell the story in either direction, why we avoid it or why we still keep it, but what historical, cultural, or other forces have pushed diabolic talk in these opposite directions?
Yeah, thanks for that. So I think you're right. It's a kind of irony of our age that the natural place, as it were, of speech about the devil, which is to say the kind of house of Christian religiosity, is the place where, in many quarters, that speech has fallen silent. Or at least become a kind of rarity, and no doubt an embarrassing one, too. And there are lots of factors which are driving that. Of course, in broad terms, I suppose, the pressure that modernity puts on Christian faith to be particularly self-critical of the elements of superstition, which might be thought to be knit into the fabric of the tradition, and to be working away ever more thoroughly to expunge those elements from the faith in order to make it modernly credible. And of course, in the early modern period, worries about witchcraft, of which thinking about the devil was closely related, were at the front end of those kinds of debates about superstition and reform. And that was certainly true amongst the kind of Protestants in the Reformed line, which are my sort of tribe, as it were, where worries about superstition were both worries about reason, but they were also worries about the ongoing entanglement of Christian faith with the older form of the religion, you know, over against which Protestants had kind of pitched themselves at the time of the Reformation. So you have those two motivations, to be sure. And I think that tends to issue in a kind of embarrassment with the texts, especially the texts of Scripture, which continue to put the language of the devil and the discourse of the devil in front of us week after week. If you're a lectionary preacher, for example, throughout the year you're obliged to confront texts in which the devil makes an appearance. And it struck me in my own listening to sermons over the course of many years, how readily a sermon would simply avoid, you know, just sort of ghost the figure of the devil, no matter how prominent the figure might well have been in the text. And I think that's a reflection of both that rational embarrassment and also a kind of ecumenical desire to be reforming the faith away from superstition. So I think that's one thing which is driving us. I think on the other side, though, and at the same time as you say, it's extraordinary when you cast your kind of eye around fields of other discourses, politics, literature, the social sciences, and so on, how meaningful and how essential even the language of the diabolical is, right? You encounter it as a sort of necessary idiom in order to give expression to our experience of the radicality of evil in the world, our sense of the meaninglessness of those things which beset the human and shape our condition. And there's a kind of naturalness to that, and a kind of surprising secular ease with that, which is also striking, and especially to the theological ear, and as you say, kind of ironic in the same sense. So my sense is that what pushes the positive recourse to the discourse of the devil in those other non-theological spheres is a sense of what the demands of confronting the reality of evil require, right? And that the need for us to try to use or to find, to identify the right language with which to give speech to the realities that confront us. And the diabolical, it turns out, is exactly the kind of idiom which does real work in our day and age to help us speak about the world in which we live. So on the one hand, the unreality of the devil as a figure of irrationality and superstition, and on the other hand, the realism of the diabolical, as it were, is exactly, as you say, this sort of strangely switched tension in our contemporary discourse.
It really is remarkable. Once you drew this to my attention, though, it really isn't much of a stretch for someone to say about a person who's addicted to drugs, or even someone who has been in abusive relationships, that this or that person has her demons or has his demons, right? So, I mean, it's on a rhetorical register. It's nothing for us to talk about the diabolic. But it has become, would you say it's become largely a psychologized metaphor, or do you think that, there's something ontologically different that's behind that in the way that we use it in sort of conversation?
Yeah. So often, of course, it's used, as you say, as a kind of trope, which evokes a sense of the quality of the problem. So say, in this case, the struggle with addiction, the sense that somehow one is what in the thrall of a power which is beyond your ken, right? Which you can't really comprehend, you can't grapple with adequately, you certainly can't wrestle it to the ground on your own. It's a kind of confrontation with a kind of possession. I mean, the analogy is right, with a kind of possession, isn't it? And so sure, the psychological is certainly one of the spheres in which that proves to be true. I think also, though, in the sphere of morals, sort of ethical reflection too, we find increasingly, especially in the wake of the Holocaust, for example, in the 20th century, a real pressure on our language to find terminology which does justice to the phenomena of evil as we experience in the world, and some of that language. The sort of hellishness of the experience of war, the sense that somehow the reach of our destructive powers is a kind of summoning of the demonic, into the midst of human life. Those sorts of ways of talking are, again, obviously inspired from the fragments of the theological tradition, and the fact that they're metaphorical uses or poetic uses, to my mind, does not diminish them in any sense as to their capacity to draw our attention to the real. Right? So I think one of the things which I'm trying to kind of gesture at in the book is that there is a kind of ontological metaphor which is fundamental to the way that theology operates as a discourse and the way in which we understand its purchase on the world around us, and that in that way it's not that different from other kinds of metaphorical or poetic speech for which we reach precisely at the extremes of our experience, right? Yeah. The experience of addiction, the experience of suffering and war, and so on.
Now, several years ago, when David Bentley Hart joined me on this show to talk about his translation of the New Testament for Yale University Press, Protestant commentaries on Paul neglect the pervasive angelology that Paul's own rhetoric. Your opening chapter invites readers to revisit an apocalyptic Paul and take seriously his demonology. So you use the phrase three-agent salvation. What does that phrase mean, and what kinds of things does it bring to our attention as we read Paul?
Good, thank you for that. Yeah, so part of the motivation for the book in my own case is exactly a kind of confrontation with this fresh reading of Paul, which is sometimes goes under the rubric of the mm-hmm. apocalyptic Paul or the apocalyptic reading of Paul. And it's an approach to Paul which takes seriously just those elements which David Bentley Hart drew out in his translation and in his conversation with you. And in doing that, it sees a couple of things which become fundamental to the interpretation of Paul and therefore also put pressure on theology that wants to keep company with Paul. And one of those things is the idea that for Paul, the work of salvation is really first and foremost a work of redemption. Mm-hmm. So a work of rescue, liberation, that should be the case because Paul imagines that the world is in the thrall and is held captive by anti-God powers. It's often the sort of summary phrase which the scholars use to capture that, which he speaks of in various ways, right? The prince of the air, the power of the spirit of the air, the power of this age, the god of this age, the devil, and so on. So in that cloud of language is a gesture at that to which the human and indeed the cosmos has fallen mm-hmm. captive. And on the model of the Exodus of Israel, the God who saves is a God who liberates, rescues, redeems God's people from that condition of captivity. Okay, so if that's the picture of salvation, that is the all-embracing one in Paul, and the question of reconciliation, guilt, forgiveness is internal to that. But if that bigger picture is a picture of redemption, then quite naturally the question kind of arises, to whom or to what is the cosmos captive, right? How ought we to speak of the anti-God powers? And those powers become, as it were, a third agent in the drama. So we might think that lots of Christians will understand the work, the business of salvation as two-agent drama. Right? There's God, and there's the malfeasant human creature, and the question of salvation is how to make good that malfeasance and to restore a broken relationship. Mm-hmm. Right? And the work of reconciliation, forgiveness, and so on addresses that concern, so a two-agent drama. But in this case, with Paul and his cosmic redemption scheme, we now have a three-agent drama. We have God, we have the human creature, and now we have the anti-God mm-hmm. powers. Right? And so we need to think with Paul of a working out of salvation in which each of those agents is involved in some way, right? And that means for the theologian who wants to sort of overhear that rereading of Paul and take it seriously and think about what kind of consequences it might have for thinking about Christian doctrine, and I count myself as that kind of theological thinker, we quite quickly find that we have to take responsibility for the meaning of that third agent, right? What if anything can we say responsibly about the third mm-hmm. agent? So we could be in a position, for example, where we think that's exactly how Paul thought, but we can't make any sense of that in our own kind of time and day, and so we find ourselves at some distance from Paul and having to kind of interpret that material mm-hmm. away, perhaps kind of demythologize it in a kind of Boltzmannian form or other kinds of exegetical maneuvers in order to compensate for the fact that we find that language impossible for us to embrace in a kind of straightforward way. Or we might find that that language actually, and this was the experience of Ernst Käsemann, for example, an important student of Bultmann and interpreter of Paul, whose thinking is part of this scene, we might think that actually Paul's language about the anti-God powers and the captivity of the cosmos is not just a good reading of Paul, but also turns out to be a kind of illuminating way to conceive of our own world, right? The world in which Käsemann and you and I mm-hmm. find ourselves, right? A world in which there does seem to be a kind of absurd and yet all too real resistance to God and the purposes right. of God. And the suggestion that talk of the third agent is both intrinsic to Paul and intelligible to us theologically, or can be taken responsibility mm-hmm. for in our contemporary theology, is kind of the wager of the book. Yeah.
Very good, very good. Well, I want to talk about the position
that stands in contrast to this book's project, and that is a broadly Augustinian project. You know, an early chapter in the book addresses the post-biblical history of Christian writing about Satan and the devils, and the story focuses to a large extent on Augustine and on the successors to Augustine. So this is one that our listeners will likely find familiar, whether they've encountered it in C.S. Lewis or whether they've encountered it in other theologians. But this is a story in which evil doesn't exist in its own right, but it only distorts goodness. The devils are not any kind of opposite of God, but they are opposites of the angels in the New Testament. And because Augustine himself is a very systematic thinker, we have a place even for devils. Yes. So what kinds of questions come to the fore, and what kinds of questions recede when, in your words, quote, grammatically, evil is only ever predicate, never subject?
Yeah. Thanks for that. So you're quite right that the Augustinian account of evil and its implications for our thinking about the devil is really one of the important themes of the early part of the book, which does a little bit of work with the history of Christian doctrine, just kind of trace the career of the devil, as it were, as a theme. And Augustine, as in so many things, is on the one hand a kind of receiver and distiller of the trajectories of the tradition to his point, and then becomes a kind of consolidated expression of that tradition, which then has a grip on, and indeed kind of abides in, subsequent theological tradition for many, many centuries to come. It was striking to me that the treatment of the devil you can find in Augustine, you can find almost verbatim all the way up into the late 19th, even early 20th century, where people are still speaking about the devil at all. They're speaking like Augustine, right?
And as I mentioned, even in C.S. Lewis, you still get it in the mid-20th century.
Just so, yeah, exactly. So, and that account is, as you say, a kind of account which associates the devil with angelology. So when we think about what kind of creature the devil is, the answer is an angel. If we ask about what kind of angel that angel is, the answer is a fallen angel. And if we ask about the quality of that fall, we're told a story of rebellion that sounds a lot like the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden. It's a kind of angelic version of the falling away from fidelity with God. The motivations for the fall of the devil vary in the tradition, sometimes pride, sometimes resentment at the at the glory of the human, you know, variety of things. But in any case, the angelic fall is a kind of repudiation of the proper angelic vocation of Lucifer, and the consequences of that fall is a kind of banishment. It's often thought that there are questions about when that fall happens. Does it happen before the human fall? Does it happen after the human fall? All kinds of interesting kind of technical debates about those sorts of things. Does the devil fall by himself, or does he take a whole crew with him? So you can imagine these sorts of themes. What's striking to me in all cases were a couple of important things. In that scheme, the devil as creature can never be evil. Right?
Right.
The reason why that's true is because no creature, qua creature, can be evil, right? To be is to be created by God, and to be created by God is to be good. So even the most perverse and dissolute creature, which might be, for example, the devil, is still, as creature, good, right? So that's kind of point number one. So we don't have, in the Augustinian tradition, an account of the devil as evil, right? There's no identity between evil and the devil. The devil is a victim of evil, right, or a sort of practitioner of evil, but never evil as such. And that's a function of his creatureliness.
Right.
The other thing is that we know a lot, as it turns out, about the devil's way of acting and way of being in the world, because we know, in the tradition, especially in the medieval period, a lot about angels, right?
Yes.
The more we know about angels, the more we can say about the quality of the devil's activity, the way the devil reasons, the way the devil can influence us or not influence us, and so on. So we actually have a lot to say traditionally about the details of both the devil's kind of being and acting. And those are related to the fact that we're thinking of the devil always as an angel. And then, as you say, the privation account of evil, which is so important, of course, in the tradition, and which I try in my own way to kind of keep company with and maybe even radicalize here, I suppose, is one in which evil is never a thing in the world. It's always the absence of those things which should be. So a kind of deficit, right? A falling away from the truth of a form, or the declination away from the proper ends of a creature. So we might think of the devil's fall, for example, as him exchanging the desire for something lower for the desire for God, which ought to be higher. So the devil, like humans, is a victim of disordered desire. And the disordering of desire is the kind of engine for sin, for malfeasance, indeed for evil. And that account, the primitive account of evil, is a powerful one. And it does a couple of important things which are worth keeping in mind. One is it ensures that evil is not a creation of God. Right? Mm-hmm. So that which God creates is good. Evil is not intrinsic to the creation. It's not an object of God's creative act or purpose, right? It's the contradiction of that action and that purpose. That insight is I think a fundamental one. Of course, in the traditional discourse, part of the ambition for thinking of evil in that way is to stop us from saying things like God is the author of evil, right?
Right.
We want to keep those kinds of claims at bay. So a primitive account helps to do that. But it also means, as you intimated too, that we always think about evil as a deficit of something which is good, right? So a human creature can't be evil all the way down. If a human creature were to become evil all the way down, it would cease to exist, right? Evil existing by itself is incomprehensible. So,
existence itself is good.
Exactly. Yeah, existence itself is good, and so evil only exists, kind of in scare quotes, as a kind of parasite on being, a parasite on good. Right. And that's a powerful way to think, you know, and it's hugely illuminating. What I guess struck me in the opening chapter of the book, however, is that when the tradition, including Augustine, treats the devil in that way, in close connection with its thinking about evil as a contradiction of creation, in its close association with angelology, as part of the question about kind of where evil came from, so kind of ideological discussion about the origins of sin, it does so, as I kind of use as a shorthand in the book, in the context of the first article of the Creed. So it's thinking about God as creator and God as providential superintender of the creation. And that's all well and good. What's sort of puzzling about that, though, the more you think about it, is that once we've spoken about the devil in that location, kind of early on in our textbook, you know, we get kind of God, mm-hmm. then we get creation. So chapter 2 on creation, we've said the things we want to say about angels, we've made mention of the fall of angels, we talked about the devil, we're kind of done with the subject. We've sort of said what needs saying. And the irony of that, of course, is that as I try to bring out, scripturally, we actually have very little kind of ground to walk on there. You know, we actually know theologically the tradition's been very confident to say quite a bit on the basis of not a whole lot of scriptural ground. But the place where we have the most scriptural discourse about the devil, which is in the text of the New Testament, in close description of the work of the Savior, that would suggest that the discussion of the person and work of Christ would be the natural place where our thickest, most kind of elaborate account of the devil should have its natural home. But ironically, it doesn't, right? It's sort of been put to bed, and in my mind, and in my reading of the tradition, largely domesticated precisely by its sort of being reduced to a question of origin, and associated with the kind of esoteric questions about angels.
Right. Well, and I mean, you know, another side of that that I mentioned earlier is that, you know, for Augustine, everything has its place. Even the things that seem chaotic have a place in an overarching architectural divine order. And so, I mean, I think you're right that, I mean, one of the things that happens when you treat the diabolic that way is that it domesticates the diabolic, And, you know, it does make, you know, certain texts in the New Testament harder to take as seriously as the New Testament seems to take them. So I want to turn to one of those New Testament texts, because this really is where your book got extremely interesting to me. Let's start with the wilderness temptation. So you note that the New Testament almost never concerns itself with diabolic ontology. You talked about that lack of origins in the New Testament, and almost exclusively with what you call diabolic antithesis, the ways that devils counteract God's intention in the world. So in your view, what has made so many Christian writers nervous about spending more time on the devil as a real adversary? And what kinds of things might Christians see more clearly? And start with the temptation narrative. If you want to talk about other episodes, you can. If we are willing to take the risk of treating the devil as a real narrative adversary to God in this story.
Yeah, good. Thank you for that. So, yeah, I think that's right. The appearance of the devil in the rendering of the narratives of the gospel is the focus of the study of the book. You know, just what mm-hmm. exactly, how does the devil appear as a third agent, right, in yeah. the dramas of the gospel? That asking and answering that question is the kind of burden of the heart of the thing. And I wanted to approach it that way as a kind of experiment, right? What if we say we just bracket for a second these questions about origin, right? We put mm-hmm. aside the question about demonic ontology. We'll come back to it, but for the time being, let's just take a fresh encounter with the devil as an actor in the narrative, right? As a character in the narrative. What do we actually learn when we pay attention to the things that the devil does, the way the devil appears in the story, the service of the devil, as it were, to the unfolding of the account of the gospel? And as you picked out so kindly, the point that emerged for me consistently is that the devil appears as a kind of radical antithesis and adversary to the movement of the Christ, right? Mm-hmm. So in a sense, the devil, the logic of the devil is to oppose Christ at every point and in every way, right? The devil, we might say, has the basic form of anti-Christ, right? The sort of contradiction of and resistance to Christ. And the contrast with that, just to pick up the tail end of your previous question, is the kind of domesticated devil of providence, right? Who is, we might think about the devil in Job, or the Satan figure in Job, for example, right? Where the devil, yes, of course, kind of causes Job all kinds of trouble, right? But does so on a pretty tight leash from God, right? Mm-hmm. Acts against what might be thought to be Job's best interest, but only in the short term, right? In the longer term, it's a pedagogical strategy, right? Job learns some important things. We all learn some important things in virtue of what Job learns about God, about God's purposes, about the sovereignty of God, and so on. So the devil is very much a kind of servant, perhaps a difficult one, perhaps a kind of, you know, awkward and contrary one, but still a servant of the outworking of divine providence. And the pedagogical testing is really the kind of the business of the Satan, the Jobian Satan. What struck me is that it's easy to, I think, in a commonplace, of course, to read the testing of Jesus in the desert in the same way, right? Here we have a kind of, you know, pedagogical testing, right? But the reading which I offer and which I think holds is actually that right from the beginning, and of course the temptation stories are set right at the beginning in all the synoptics of the unfolding mm-hmm. of Jesus' ministry, the devil appears to call into question the direction and the nature of Christ's messianic vocation, right?
Right.
So what is this ministry to be about? Where is it going? How will it be achieved? We might just call that the way, right? What is mm-hmm. What is the nature of the movement of Christ? What way does the Messiah have to go in order to fulfill those purposes of the one who sent him, right? And be the servant of those to whom he sent? What does that have to look like? And the temptations arise at the outset as a kind of triple questioning of the way of the Messiah as a way to the cross. Maybe it's possible, the devil suggests in the exchanges, that that Jesus could be the Christ otherwise, right? Maybe it's possible by economic power or religious spectacle, right? Or whatever. There are other means. Maybe we can do this another way, right? Maybe you can become the king of the coming kingdom in another way, right? And so that, we might think of that as testing, but it seemed to me much more a kind of strategy of contradiction, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus's path is the path of the cross, and the work of the tempter is to contradict that path, right? No, here's another path. Here's a different path. Right. Part of the way in which one of the things which helped me see that is when I made the connection, and I tried to draw this out in the exposition, between the temptations and the confrontation that Jesus has with Peter around the time or the portion of the narrative where Peter confesses that Christ is the Messiah, and then when Christ goes on to explicate the path to Jerusalem and the journey to the cross, Peter says that can't be true, right? He denies that is going to be the path.
And in fact, exactly. He rebukes him, which is the verb that the Gospel of Mark uses for what Jesus does
exactly.
to
devils. Yeah. So the same language that's used, as you say, to rebuke a demon in the work of exorcism, about which we might say more in a minute, he also uses a Peter here. And, of course, mm-hmm. he describes Peter, he names Peter as Satan, right? Get behind me, Satan. And you might think, well, okay, hyperbole, fair enough. But, in fact, I think there's something very appropriate there and very telling about the use of the language of Satan at just that point. Because, again, just like in the temptations themselves, at the outset of the ministry, here, towards the climax of the ministry, Peter puts the question again. Surely you could be Messiah otherwise, right? Surely you can go into Jerusalem in a different way, right? Surely we can bring this about by other means. Not the path of the cross, not the way of the cross, but some other path, right? And it's exactly that Jesus rebukes as the satanic contradiction, right? And as I try to say in the book too, I think it's possible for us to hear the wrestling of Jesus in the garden in Gethsemane as a kind of internal echo, as it were, of the same temptation, right? Is it possible that this cup could go otherwise, that someone else could drink this, or maybe it doesn't have to be drunk at all, maybe I don't have to go this path? That the fact that the narrative puts right on the eve of the passion a kind of third cycle of contradiction, right? Again, a calling into question of the way of the Messiah as the way of the cross is particularly striking. So kind of seen in its whole, the temptations become that kind of opening move of a contradiction of Christ's path, which is sort of comes to a climax in a way, and ironically so perhaps, in the person of Peter, and then also has this kind of difficult interior echo in the scene in the garden. But in all cases, it's not a testing, right? Jesus won't be the better for having kind of learned a lesson from all of this, right? It's an active attempt to contradict and obstruct the movement of the Messiah as the movement to the cross, right? And it has no other positive end, right? So this is another thing. We were talking about privation before. One of the things which strikes me about the quality of the devil's agency as an actor in the Gospels is that it has no purpose except to contradict, right? The devil's not after some positive purpose and happens to contradict Christ kind of in the working out of that purpose. It is the purpose, if we can speak that way, of the devil simply to contradict, right? So,
Right. And it's interesting. That's a formula that Goethe employs. Mephistopheles calls himself the spirit who contradicts.
That's right.
So, I have no idea what to do with that contradiction, but it just now occurred to me. But honestly, this is one of the things I like best about this little book, is that it gets departments of the seminary talking to each other. So on one hand, you know, you talk about that privation that is an Augustinian inheritance. On the other hand, you talk about, you know, the pervasive exorcisms that happen in the synoptic narratives. And, you know, that's a commonplace when you take your very first, you know, introduction to New Testament class in seminary. When those two departments get together, though, you get this investigation of demonic possession that doesn't have any kind of strategic end to it. You know, the demons do not possess people for the sake of some kind of larger strategic end down the line. So with that connection that normally we don't get because, you know, seminary departments don't talk to each other, what kinds of things might we investigate theologically if we think about possession and possession narratives in connection with privation?
Yeah, this I think was one of the portions of the book which was most challenging to me as a theologian. So kind of crossing, as you say, crossing the hall and imploring the help of my New Testament colleagues, who are very open-handed here at Aberdeen, to ask about, is there a way to think, or how can we think, how must we think responsibly about the theological significance of these narratives, right? And there are several things which are noteworthy, I think, or at least which struck me as crucial. One is just the ubiquity of exorcistic activity on the part of Christ. I mean, whatever else the Jesus of the Gospels is, he is an exorcist. That's interesting. And again, that's awkward in our day and age. And so the ease with which we can circumvent that fact is a striking one. So wanting to just grab that nettle and kind of think it through was part of the struggle. I think there were several things which came to light when I found myself trying to be patient on these texts. One is that intriguingly, and again, it's sort of obvious, and you think, oh well, you should never have not known that. But it's easy, I think, for us to lose sight of the fact that the possessed are never the enemies of the Christ on the pages of the gospel. They're always victims of this third power, right? They're never cast as opponents of the kingdom, or as those who are actively resisting the kingdom, or those who are against Christ. Not ever, right? They're always victims of this a depleting power which occupies them. So that's the first thing. So they're in a way they're a kind of radical expression of the need for redemption, right? They've sort of fallen captive. The world as a whole is captive to these anti-God powers. These individual instances are kind of radical exemplars of that captivity. So in a way, there's a kind of continuity between mm-hmm. the general situation and the kind of radical extremes of the possessed, which is important, right? Their condition is not alien to the condition as a whole. So that's important to mm-hmm. me, and again, is theologically, I think, quite notable. I think the other thing is that the effect of their being possessed is to dissolve their relationship with the world around them, right? To dissolve their communal bounds. And there are several kind of ways in which you see that narrated in the stories. I mean, we often find them kind of outside the walls, you know, in the graveyards outside the city gate. They're sort of in exile. Exactly. They've been pushed out to the margins. They're not integrated in the community anymore. There's one lovely example where there's a woman who's possessed. Jesus performs, as it were, an exorcism, and the language of in which the text speaks about the woman shifts from. At the beginning, she's just called woman, and at the end of the story, she's called daughter of Israel. And it's interesting that the narrator should have chosen to sort of symbolize the reintegration, as it were, or the restoration of that woman to the community, you know, kind of knit back into the society, as it were, as a consequence of the work of exorcism. So whatever else exorcism is, it's the kind of activity which affords the possibility and the reality of reintegration into mm-hmm. the community. And that's a striking feature of the stories, again, time after time after time. I guess the thing that really struck me overall is that the Gospel of Mark, but also the others, the two other synoptics too in their own way, it's one of the rare times when we get a parable put in the mouth of Jesus, which serves as a kind of self-interpretation of his activity. Right? And this one, it's the parable of the strong man, right? The strong man kind of wearing his armor, defending his house, and he's overtaken, right, by the one who invades the strong man's house and binds him and pillages it, right? So in other words, kind of, you know, redeems those things which have been stolen and collected there. You think of it like a kind of stronghold. And Jesus tells that story precisely on the back of one of the first of, especially in Mark, it comes early. one of the first exorcisms, right? So it's a kind of interpretation of what's going on here, right? And it positions the work of exorcism as expressive of the repossession, as it were, of the illegitimately usurped world, right? We have creatures who are illicitly overrun by these anti-God powers, and it's the work of the Christ to, in effect, repossess the possessed, right? To recover them, to bring them back under the lordship of Christ, to win them out from under this alien captivity. And that stands as a kind of rubric over the whole of Christ's ministry. It's quite striking that the mm-hmm. parable of the strong man, or the binding of the strong man. So that's one thing. The other thing that again, it's one of these things you think, how did you not notice this? John's gospel, interestingly, has no exorcisms, right? Jesus performs no exorcisms.
Right.
That's the piece which I somehow had not really clocked in my own kind of reflection. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that, there's a puzzle. Well, I mean, why should that be, right? The importance of exorcism in the other Gospels is so striking, and here it's absent in its entirety. But it turns out, of course, that it's not absent in its entirety, because the author of the Gospel of John thinks of and describes the whole of Christ's ministry as one great exorcism, as several commentators put it, right? So the work of Christ comes to a culmination in words which Christ himself is given to say, now the ruler of this age is cast out, right? So the culmination of the work mm-hmm. of the Bethlehem to Golgotha existence of Christ is the exorcism of the world, as it were, right? The casting out of the illegitimate ruler of this age. So in all of these ways, the work of Christ to kind of bring life into the place where death has come to reign, to displace the illegitimate reign of death, as it were, or the sovereignty of death over these lives, and to replace it with the sovereignty of the one who is life, is kind of the business of Christ as exorcist. And again, that's integral to his person, integral to his identity, integral to his work, so not at all marginal. And it becomes, mm-hmm. it shows you the difference it makes when you notice how important this contretemps with the devil and the sort of anti-God powers is. It really does structure some of the most fundamental patterns in the gospel narrations.
Right. Well, I want to stick with John, because one of my favorite distinctions in your John section is the distinction between ontological ultimate origins of demonic entities. And you note rightly that John doesn't care much at all about the ultimate ontological origins of devils. And on the other hand, the evangelical origins of devils, your phrase, which John's Jesus talks about with some frequency. So what is an evangelical origin? And when we pay attention to those, what kinds of things do we notice in John? Yeah.
So John's gospel is, of course, distinctive in all kinds of interesting ways as students of the Gospels know, and there are features of it which are quite striking in relation to the character of the devil. So one of the things, of course, is just it's built on a kind of rolling kind of dualism, right? John's Gospel is mm-hmm. just idiomatically kind of rife with talk about life and death and light and dark, right? And the kind of conflict between those things. The world and the church, sort of strong oppositional kinds of logic. And the figure of the Christ and his contest with the devil is set forth in just those kinds of dualistic sorts of terms in John. In particular, John's interested in thinking of Christ as the revelation of God, right? The one who glorifies the Father and is himself glorified. That glorification is a kind of light trope, so kind of the one who illumines what's really going on, right? Which brings light to show the truth about the situation we're in and dispels the darkness, our false and shadowy misunderstanding about what's really true or about in the world. So the importance of Christ as truth is fundamental to John's particular kind of witness. And when I think about the kind of evangelical origin, as I put it, of the figure of the devil in John. The devil really appears in that particular telling as the contradiction of Christ as the truth, right? So it's the appearance of truth, right? When truth appears,
exactly. The father of lies,
yeah, when truth appears, then the resistance to truth erupts, right? It could be that the resistance to truth has been latent all the time, or perhaps it's evoked kind of especially by the arrival of truth. But the advent of the one who is the truth brings about issues in the resistance. And so you get a particular kind of description in John of the way in which the true identity of Christ, the true purposes of God, the true description of the nature of the kingdom, the true nature of salvation, all of these things are kind of under assault, as it were, by the one who, in John's phrase, is the father of lies. Yeah. So the idea then, too, and here again, you pick up the privation kind of notion in an interesting way. You know, lies come in all kinds of forms, right? Yes, of course, they come in straight. You can just directly contradict something in an attempt to falsify it. But more often than not, resistance to truth, you know, takes all kinds of other forms, right? Indirection, kind of the passable half-truth,
right,
the kind of ironic smirking way of saying the thing that is true, but in a manner that corrodes it from inside. Silence, right? All kinds of ways in which you can betray the truth. And as I try to work out in that particular chapter, we see all of those strategies at work, right? And they amount to so many different kinds of betrayals. I mean, I think John's Gospel wants to cast it chiefly as a kind of relationship. Our relationship to the truth is a kind of relationship in which we can keep true, we can be true to the truth, we can keep troth, it's an old-fashioned word, you know, kind of be people who hold the truth in fidelity, so we can keep faith with the truth, or we can betray it. And there are a thousand ways to betray the truth, and we see those at crucial moments in John's Gospel. And here, if Peter and the confrontation with Jesus and the rebuking is the sort of hub of one of the earlier encounters in the other tellings, here in John's Gospel, the confrontation with Judas and, of course, the confrontation with Pilate are the two moments in which I think the question of truth and untruth are kind of brought to a head, right? In a way, Judas, the true disciple in all kinds of ways, who yet turns out to be the kind of most intimate betrayer, right? And again, for no particular reason, right? The money, you know, it's there. He has no motivation, right? It's a kind of mysterious contradiction of the truth for its own sake, as it were. And then in a different kind of way, the figure of Pilate, of course, who famously gets to ask the question in the telling of the gospel, you know, what is truth, confronted with Jesus? Self-declaration that he is the truth. That question, even if you don't take it kind of sarcastically, you have lots of reasons to think you might, but even if you don't take it sarcastically, Pilate is a kind of betrayer of truth, because in the telling, he, and the story works hard to set him up like this, he knows that the crowd is handing over somebody who shouldn't be handed over, right? He knows, right? So there's a kind of betrayal of the truth in the sense that the political expediency, the need to kind of manage the violence of the crowd, you know, all the kind of calculus of the management of juridical violence is at work there. And it's exactly prudence which betrays the truth here, right? So not only kind of the most obvious kinds of personal betrayal, which we might use the word evil, kind of straightforwardly, say the figure of Judas, but also prudential calculation, which tries to minimize the political damage of the confrontation with the, which you might think is just good statecraft, right? Even that is also a betrayal of the truth. So the kind of breadth, the breadth and the manifold varieties of ways in which the truth can be resisted, corroded, and so on, is a kind of interesting feature of John's Gospel. It's instructive to us, I think, theologically too, right? That we ought not to look for the contradiction of the truth of Christ only in those places where it strikes us as most obvious, right? But in fact, it's most likely to be going on, and most effectively and most dangerously going on, in those places where it's covering its own tracks, or where it looks like prudence, or looks like wisdom, or looks like, you know, faithfulness or something, right?
Yeah, I'm reminded of, and I know classicists hate this etymology, but I return to it again and again, irrespective, but Martin Heidegger's etymology of aletheia, you know, the Greek term that gets translated in English Bibles as truth, that, you know, he links it to the Greek verb lanthano, and he says that, you know, lanthano means to conceal or to forget, so aletheia is the process of unignoring, unconcealing, unforgetting things. And that's always struck me as something that could be informative at the very least for, you know, a lot of context, you know. You know, I think of the scholarly world, you know, what does it mean to get the truth at, to get at, pardon me, the truth of a historical event? Well, it means to unignore things that before people tended to ignore. And that, you know, I realize that, again, classicists have spilled a lot of ink showing that Martin Heidegger didn't know Greek very well. But I think that, you know, as a metaphor, it still works pretty well for truth.
Yeah, I agree. Concealment is an interesting way of thinking about the one of the primary ways in which truth is contradicted, right? Kind of forgetfulness too. Interesting. What it allows us to do is it gives us a kind of range of a kind of continuum of ways of resisting the truth, from the kind of most trivial to the most open and, you know, kind of obvious ones. But we can associate them all with the self same spirit of resistance to truth, right? You know, from the kind of from the white lie to the pretending you didn't hear something to the throwing a dish towel over that because you don't want your spouse to see it, to, you know, all the way down to the kind of handing over of your rabbi to the authorities, which again is also, I should say, also a kind of prudential act, right?
Caiaphas is nothing if not prudential.
Exactly. Yeah. And the association of prudence with evil and with the devil here is really, I think that is a really, that's a challenging, that is a challenging piece of witness in John's gospel. That precisely where we think we might be doing the wise and prudent thing, precisely in doing those things, we can also be at one and the same time the enemies of the truth. That's something to sit with, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I talked about one of Martin Heidegger's images. I want to talk about a couple of your images from this book as we reach the end of our hour here. One of them is the idea that if we take diabolic narrative seriously, if we get our theology department talking to our biblical studies department, then we see that salvation is redemption and it's also rescue.
Right.
So talk about that metaphor of rescue. What kinds of things do we, again, what kinds of things do we notice that we don't notice if we don't think of salvation as rescue as well as redemption?
Yeah. Good, thank you. So I think one of the important payoffs for me from this thinking about the theme of the devil again is precisely to bring to light the sort of varied contours of our way of thinking about salvation, right? And mm-hmm. to try to sort of acknowledge afresh that the work of salvation has to deal with more than just one problem, right? So maybe come back to our kind of two and three agent discussion from before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the standard ways, totally legitimate, of course, way of thinking about salvation is to conceive it as a two-agent drama, God and the human, God and the people of God. The problem to which salvation is addressed then is often human infidelity, right? Unrighteousness, law, mm-hmm. law-breaking, malfeasance.
Rebellion.
Exactly, rebellion. And then the way that needs to get resolved, the work of salvation requires what? Judgment, forgiveness, reconciliation. There's a kind of cloud of appropriate concepts. Good. All fundamentally good and important. What struck me about this, though, is that part of the drama that deals with our, if I can put it this way, our kind of complicity, right, with sin or our complicity in sin is really embedded in a larger framework, and that is our captivity to the third agent powers. Right. So it strikes me that a doctrine of salvation needs to address both of those registers. It needs to speak to the rescue, the liberation of the human being from that captivity, and then it also has to speak to the reconciliation of that rescued creature or that redeemed creature from its complicity with its own captivity, right? Because we're not mm-hmm. cast simply as victims of demonic and anti-god powers. We're also cast as their domesticated house servants, as it were, right? Kind of, I don't know if people remember this anymore, but when I was a teenager, I remember reading about something called Stockholm Syndrome, which is where people who are taken...
It's a common phrase on the internet, so keep
people who are taken captive by kidnappers often come to kind of associate themselves with the kidnappers, affiliate their affects with them, indeed eventually kind of take their side, right? They find themselves aligned with their kidnappers in kind of mysterious and surprising ways. And there's something, I think there's a touch of the Stockholm Syndrome in the way that the New Testament conceives of the problem of sin, right? We are, on Paul's witness and also the witness of the Gospels, captive to these kinds of powers, right? And as captives, we also find ourselves complicit with them, right? Beverly Gaventa, who's one of the New Testament scholars who's helped to pioneer this work on the apocalyptic reading.
I'm actually reading one of her books right now for this show.
Oh, you'll love it. Excellent. She's a fine, fine interpreter.
So far, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it'll be wonderful right to the end. She has this image that she's reached for on several occasions to try to articulate this kind of combined sense of captivity and complicity. And it's the image of the child soldier, right? And it's a powerful one because it's kind of one that we're familiar with in a kind of horrible way from our exposure to the media that tells us what's going on in the world. But the child soldier is a sort of, on the one hand, of course, the child is not, you know, is a kind of victim, right? You know, probably been taken away from their home, kind of recruited, cultivated for this work. And yet the child soldier is also the one who pulls the trigger and sets fire to the house, right? So on the one hand, captive, and on the other hand, complicit, right? So we need, I think, an account of salvation in Christian theology which is capacious enough to handle all of that, right? It has to be addressed to our captivity, which means it has to be a theology of redemption, of rescue, of liberation, and it also has to be addressed to our complicity with our own captivity. So it also has to include within it, nested within it, an account of reconciliation, forgiveness, judgment, and so on. I think the ordering of those things is important, right? That the doctrine of reconciliation, as it were, is internal. It's kind of nested inside a larger, more comprehensive account of redemption. And that ordering has been something which, working with the reading of Paul and also thinking through this account of the devil, has really helped me to solidify the importance of that, right? That we really don't do justice to the breadth of what God wills to save and repair if we don't think of both captivity and our complicity. If we simply have a doctrine of salvation that's addressed to our malfeasance or the disordering of our desire as such, I don't think it's comprehensive enough, right? There are entanglements, there are captivities which are also part of that from which we need to be saved, right? One of the I think the hopeful things about this book, although of course it's about the devil, so it's sort of backhandedly hopeful, is that it draws to mind the scope of salvation. Right, the kind of range, the depth of the problem, as it were, helps to illumine or to bring to light afresh the breadth of the solution, or if you'd rather, the radicality of the problem helps to bring to light afresh the radicality and breadth of the solution. So it is a kind of way, kind of, we're sort of backing into an expanded and radicalized doctrine of salvation. And I guess that's really what's finally motivating my thinking in this area. In any case, you know, I think we have a kind of interest in the devil, not for its own sake. We have a kind of theological interest in the devil because we have an interest in Christ and his work, right? And it's in order to do justice, to do better justice to that person and that work, that it's important, it seems to me, to pay attention to the theme.
That's good. I want to note one more thing before we wrap things up, and that is at the close of the book, you do note that shifting the ways that we talk about the devil and about evil poses certain dangers for our souls. And one of the big dangers to our soul has to do with partisan weaponization of devil talk. So, before we wrap up, what kinds of practices and what kinds of disciplines do you recommend that our listeners can benefit? Let me back that up.
Sure.
What kinds of practices and disciplines do you recommend so that our listeners can benefit from a Christological revision of diabology without refusing to love one's enemies?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So, one of the ways in which I think of the book as a whole and the contribution that I would hope the book might make is that I think into that vacuum of sort of brought about by the absence of theological speech about the devil with which we began, into that absence, all kinds of irresponsible stuff can flow, right?
Yes.
When theologians and Christians have stopped speaking responsibly about the devil, they vacated a place in which, as the parable goes, 77 other kind of devils might well want to show up. So, yep. So that there's a way in which I think disciplining our speech about the devil in the way that I'm ambitious to try to help us do with the book is a way of displacing all manner of irresponsible speech, though, which otherwise we might kind of traffic with. So in the first instance, mm-hmm. I think that itself is already a pushing back against the kind of ways in which devil rhetoric, the demonization of opponents, is at work in theological and Christian speech. You know, I think if we can reform our thinking and speaking about the devil in these kinds of ways, then a whole series of those things become impossible, right? They're just unintelligible theologically. Mm-hmm. And we're helped to notice that and to own the consequences of that, I think, if we think more carefully about it. I think the other thing that strikes me as important is that differentiating the devil out as an agent, if I can say it like that, also means that we kind of open a gap between the devil and any particular creature.
Right.
So, you know, none of our enemies is the devil, right? We mm-hmm. might think that they're, I don't know, in the thrall of the devil or what have you, but they're never the devil, right?
And even that thrall language shifts the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, in a way, kind of like the way in which the possessed are never properly the enemies of Christ, but are in fact in the thrall of, as it were, possessed by the anti-God powers. Likewise, you know, to the extent that we think and speak about the world in these ways, we're reminded time and time again that no human creature is simply coextensive with evil. Right? This is to pick up the point we learned from Augustine way back when: to be a creature is to be good. Right? And that puts a limit, a hard one and an important one, on the meaningfulness of speech about evil. When it comes to the way that we work with each other. And I think by recovering a notion of the devil as radical evil in the way that I'm trying to work out here, I think I help to kind of support that grammar, right? You know, we speak of creatures as creatures, mm-hmm. but the devil as a kind of not God nor creature, or kind of neither God nor creature, gives us a place to speak about evil with that radicality, which is reserved. Precisely reserved for that one, right? I think that helps too. I mean, I think the other thing is that the depiction of the resistance to Christ, which I take to be the narrative building up of the identity of the devil and the devil's works on the pages of the Gospels so often involves not distant enemies, but intimately close ones, right? I mean, it's Peter and Judas who are most closely identified with the language of Satan right inside the circle of the disciples, right? So not those folks over there, right? Not the enemy abroad, right? But us, right? So I would think it's crucial that a theological account of the devil that's responsible is in the first instance always drawing attention to the way in which the strategies and tactics of resistance to Christ, which we encounter in and are kind of personified in the work of the devil on the pages of the New Testament, that those strategies and tactics are ones that are first and foremost ones that we're going to see in our own Christian lives, right? It's a way of helping us to pay attention to our own ongoing complicity, if I can put it that way, right? With the same strategies and tactics of resistance to Christ. So in the first instance, it becomes a kind of tool of discernment, right? Self-discernment. And I would think only laterally a kind of discourse which we might think about wielding in conversation with other people about their situations. I mean, I think we're led to think about that chiefly because it draws attention to the fact that our own sinfulness is a kind of ongoing complicity, and it also gives us a kind of grammar of sin, if I can put it like that, right? This threefold resistance to Christ as the way to the cross, the resistance to Christ as the life, and the resistance to Christ as the truth. Those resistances are ever the sort of threefold ways in which Christians also continue to betray the truth, resist, and corrode their life and the life of others, and you know the manifold ways in which Christian life and discourse seem to suggest that it would be much better if Christ were another kind of Messiah, right. You know, slightly more habitable, slightly less difficult, slightly less demanding. You know, all of those things, those are things which are a work in our own selves and in our own communities. So I would think the engagement with the devil or the discernment of the devil begins at home, I think, would be one of the other observations I would make. And I think that observation is one which is funded from exactly paying attention to the way in which the devil appears in the witness to the gospel itself.
Very good. Well, Phil, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about devils, theology, biblical exegesis, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Okay. That's very good. It struck me, thinking and speaking about this book in recent weeks, how important it is for me, and I hope also perhaps for readers, that the book be received as a kind of inverse Christology, or a kind of backhanded way of thinking about the gospel. It is a book, of course, about the devil, but it's really a book about that against which the devil moves. Right? It's really a book about the person of Christ, the quality of Christ's messianic being and action for us. It's really a book about the breadth and depth of salvation. Right? And that those positive themes, as it were, are seen in a kind of inverse light, or we kind of back into them, as it were, or we get to learn something fresh about them in a sort of backhanded way by paying attention to the devil in this way. So, and I think that's something that I think is both true, and I think it's also kind of important for the way that we calibrate our interest in the devil, in the demonic, that not sure that there's ever really what we might call a kind of proper Christian interest in the theme of the devil or the demonic. There's a kind of improper interest, and we have a proper interest in Christ, and we have a proper interest in the gospel of salvation. And it's because of that proper interest that we also find we have a kind of derivative interest in the devil, and so that getting that proportion sort of and ordering right seems important to me. Someone who I was speaking to just today had just kindly read through the book, and he said, you said it's a book about the devil, but it's actually a Christology book. I was thinking, that's I'm very glad that someone should say that, because I do hope that that's true.
Very good. Phil Ziegler, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is God's Adversary and Ours from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.